This program is brought to you by BibleWayMedia.org, overseen by the Ooligah Church of Christ in Ooligah, Oklahoma.
Welcome to our program today. This is Don Boyd with the Blue Springs Church of Christ. I want to welcome you to Opening the Scriptures. We're going to continue in our studies today of the 15 periods of Bible history, and we come now to the second period of Bible history, and that is the post-diluvian period. And the subtitle of today's lesson would be The Progression of Sin. But again, the second period of Bible history is the post-diluvian period. It covers about 425 years from the end of the flood to the call of Abram. That would be Genesis chapter 8, verse 13, through chapter 11, verse 26. Events that occurred during the post-diluvian period are such things as the promise of no other flood to cover the earth, and it was signified or promised by the rainbow. The death of Noah. Noah's generations are given up to Abram. We have the event at the Tower of Babel and other things. Again, today's lesson is going to be one that is as old as Noah and yet is as relevant as the air that we breathe. I want to focus on an event that occurred in Genesis chapter 9 and observe the progression of sin. When we go to Genesis chapter 8, you know, we're going to look at the situation here. When we go to Genesis chapter 8, verses 15 through 18, the flood has now ended. Genesis 8, verses 15 to 18. And God spake unto Noah, saying, Go forth of the ark, thou and thy wife, and thy sons' wives with thee. Bring forth with thee every living thing that is with thee, of all flesh, both of fowl and of cattle, and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, that they may breed abundantly in the earth, and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. And Noah went forth, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. So there the flood has ended, and Noah and his family are blessed. Genesis chapter 9, verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth. Also at this time, animals and plants are given as food for mankind. Genesis 9, 2, and 3. It says, And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. So right there, animals were given to mankind to eat. We find over in 1 Timothy chapter 4, want to look at verses 1 through 4, that the same is true today. 1 Timothy chapter 4, and I'm going to look at verses 1 through 4. It says, Now the Spirit speaketh expressly, that in the latter time some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from meats which God hath created, to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. For every creature of God is good, and nothing to be refused, if it be received with thanksgiving. And in verse 5, For it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. So both animals and plants are given to mankind for food, and they were given to mankind by God. Now, in Genesis chapter 9, verses 4 through 17, and we're not going to read all these verses, but there are time-encompassing laws and covenants made that are universal in nature. First, we'll see that blood and things strangled are not to be eaten. In Genesis chapter 9, verse 4, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall ye not eat. When we look in Leviticus chapter 17, verses 10 and 11. Leviticus chapter 17, verses 10 and 11. It says, and whatsoever man there be of the house of Israel, or the strangers that sojourn among you, that eateth any manner of blood, I will even set my face against that soul that eateth blood, and will cut him off from among his people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given it you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul. So there under the law that Noah lived under, the patriarchal law, also under the law of Moses, they were forbidden to eat blood. And then also we go to Acts chapter 15, verse 20, and today the same is true as well. Acts chapter 15, verse 20. It says there, but that we write unto them, and what we're looking at here is the brethren there that were in Jerusalem, and they're writing to the Gentiles, begin up there in verse 13, tells us that. Verse 20, that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornications, from things strangled, and from blood. So that's one example of a law or covenant that is universal in nature through every period there of time. A second thing that we notice is that capital punishment is implemented. Genesis chapter 9, verses 5 and 6. Genesis 9, 5 and 6. And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. Now we go to Exodus chapter 21. Look at verses 12 through 14. Exodus chapter 21, verses 12 through 14. It says there, he that smiteth a man so that he die shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then will I appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. But if a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. So under the patriarchal system and under the Mosaic system, the death penalty were used. The death penalty is also scriptural today. Go to Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 4. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he, that is the governmental powers, is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is a minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So he does not bear the sword in vain. A sword is not an instrument used to tickle the ribs, and a sword is used as an instrument of death. Now, I've heard some try to argue, well, the sword there, well, they use the sword to cut up lettuce and things like that, which is just totally ridiculous whenever you look at the argumentation that is used. The sword here is talking about the individual of the government who has the authority given by God to execute whatever the government decides is worthy of execution. You know, under the patriarchal system, if a man shed another man's blood, he was to die. Under the Mosaic system, there were several different things that people did that they were to die for. One was shedding of man's blood, another one was worshiping of false gods, another one was homosexuality, and such things as that, adultery, and such things as that, they were to be put to death. But also under the New Testament, as we see, we are to be put to death at whatever the government rules to be worthy of execution. Now you go to Acts chapter 25, verse 11. Acts chapter 25, verse 11. Here Paul was standing there. You know, he was being judged by, you know, Felix and then Festus, and then Herod came in as well. And he's appealed to Caesar here in verse 11. But he says this: "For if I be an offender or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal to Caesar." So Paul right there said, if there is anything under the Roman law that I should be put to death for, I refuse not to die. But then he said, I haven't done anything under Roman law to be put to death for. And that's why he appealed to Caesar, because they were going to kill him if they got the opportunity to do that. That would be the Jews that were referring to. So capital punishment is implemented. You know, people today try to look at it as something evil. Capital punishment prevents crime. It prevents murder. And somebody will say, well, no, it doesn't. Well, it prevents the one that's been executed from doing it again. You know, people get ridiculous. You know, the wisdom of the world against the wisdom of God. God's wisdom is much more. You know, God says, what does Paul write there in the Corinthian letter? God's foolishness is wiser than men. But, of course, God's foolishness that is talking about there in those verses is the preaching of the gospel. But let's go on. Another time encompassing covenant that was made. The rainbow was given. Go back to Genesis chapter 9 and let's look at verses 8 through 17. Genesis 9, 8 through 17. And God spake unto Noah and to his sons with him, saying, And I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you, and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl and of the cattle, and of every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. And I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there be any more a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, This is the token of the covenant which I have made between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. Verse 13. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, This is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. So the rainbow was there given as a covenant, a promise of God, that he would no more destroy all flesh from off the earth with a flood. That is just another proof that the flood of Noah's day was a worldwide flood. Because if God had only caused a local flood and he would no longer cause a local flood, then God lied, because there have been numerous local floods throughout history since the time of Noah. But there has not been a universal flood, which is what the flood of Noah's day would be. Another point we want to make on this is there are those that have taken the rainbow and made it into a symbol of abomination. That is, the homosexual community has used the rainbow. Well, God's covenant is the rainbow, and they are misusing that as trying to say that God accepts homosexuality. God does not accept homosexuality. One of these days, I'm going to do a lesson on that, because homosexuality is an abomination to God. Just as lying and pride and hands that are swift to, you know, doing wicked things, you know, all those things are an abomination to God. And people don't want to have their lifestyle called criminal, but it is, because it is sin. Now, all these laws and the covenants that we've looked at are still in force today. They're still in force today, except we're not under the patriarchal law, we're not under the Mosaic law, we're under the law of Christ. And those various things, blood and things strangled, capital punishment, the rainbow, those are all still in force. Now, going back to Genesis there, Noah and Noah and his sons got on with their post-flood lives. We have Shem, who is the father of the Semites. Shem is called the father of the children of Eber. Genesis chapter 10, verse 21. It says, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, even to him were children born. So we have the name or the list of children there that were born to Shem. That's his genealogy. His descendants are shown in Genesis chapter 11. Verses 10 through 14. It says, these are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And Shem lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years and begat sons and daughters. So verses 10, now let's go ahead through verse 14, verse 12 now. And Arphaxad lived 35 years and begat Shelah. And Arphaxad lived after he begat Shelah 403 years and begat sons and daughters. And Shelah lived 30 years and begat Eber. And Shelah lived after he begat Eber 403 years and begat sons and daughters. And Eber lived 430 years and begat Peleg. And Eber lived after he begat Peleg 430 years and begat sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reu. And Peleg, after he begat Reu, 209 years and begat sons and daughters. Now, I wanted to read through that because you see the lifespan of individuals is getting less and less and less after the flood. But also something else there, we noticed that he was the father of Eber. Eber is most likely where the word Hebrew came from. And Abram is called the Hebrew in Genesis chapter 14, verse 13. Genesis 14, 13. It says, and there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. So Abraham or Abram here is called the Hebrew. Now, next we go to Genesis chapter 10, verse 6. Genesis 10, 6, and we see Ham. Ham is another son of Noah, and he is the father of dark-skinned people. Chapter 10, verse 6. It said, and the sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. And then it gives the the descendants there of these. Cush was the father of the Babylonians. It mentions Mizraim there as one of his sons. He's the father of the Egyptians. Phut was the father of the Libyans, and Canaan was the father of the Canaanites. Let's look at Genesis 10, 15 through 19 there. It says, and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite, and afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. So he's the family, from Ham came the Egyptians and the Libyans, the Babylonians, and here the Canaanites. And then his third son, Japheth, Noah's third son, was the father of Caucasian people. In Genesis 10:5, they are called the Isles of the Gentiles. It says here, let's see, verse 2 is where we want to begin in Genesis 10. The sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madai, Javan and Tubal and Meshach and Tyrus, the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarmah, the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. So Japheth there was the father basically of the European peoples. In Genesis chapter 9, verse 20, Noah began to till the soil and he planted a vineyard. Genesis chapter 9, verse 20, it says, and Noah began to be a husbandman and he planted a vineyard. Some commentators say this may have been Noah's occupation before he became a carpenter and built the ark, while others say that, you know, this is just something that Noah began to do, but whatever it is, he may have returned to his pre-flood occupation, he may not, but he planted a vineyard. Now, in chapter 9, verse 21, we begin to see the progression of sin. The first part of verse 21 of Genesis chapter 9 says, and he drank of the wine and was drunken. The Bible abounds with warnings against drinking alcohol. Now, there are some that say that maybe Noah didn't know anything about alcohol, but you think about the world had been in existence now for over 1,600 years. And you would think that probably alcohol had something to do with the wickedness of man was great in the earth that we read there in Genesis chapter 6. But regardless, let's look at some of the warnings that the Bible gives about drinking alcohol. Let's go to the book of Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. So what is he saying there? If you drink wine or if you drink strong drink, and the wine in their day wasn't near as strong as the wine of our day, he says, you're not wise. You know what that means? You're a fool. You are a fool if you drink alcohol in any amount. Let's go to Proverbs 23, verses 29 to 35. Proverbs 23, 29 to 35. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babblings? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red. You notice right there? He says, do not look on the wine when it is red. I want to go to my little e-sword here, and I want to look at the word look there. That's Proverbs 23. And down there in verse 30. The word look, verse 31. The word look there, and this is Brown Driver Briggs' definition, is to look at, to see, to inspect, to perceive, to consider. To look at, this is their one of the definitions, to look at, see, regard, look after, learn about, observe, watch, look upon, look out, find out. So what is he saying here? Don't even consider wine when it is red, when it giveth its color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. Don't even consider it. And people say that Jesus made water into wine there, and alcoholic wine in John chapter 2. If Jesus did that, he sinned. Jesus made non-alcoholic wine. Well, let's go on here in Proverbs 23, verse 32. At the last it biteth like a serpent, and stingeth like an adder. The word sting there means to wound. Like an adder. And of course, you know, what is an adder? An adder is a viper. So it wounds like a viper. Verse 33, thine eyes shall behold strange women, and thine heart shall utter perverse things. You're no longer in control after you take one drink. There was a man here at the preacher's luncheon here a few months ago, it was, but he said that he had taken his wife in to have an optometrist appointment. And one thing that the optometrist asked was, have you had any alcohol at all today? Because if you've had just one drink of wine, they could not get an accurate reading on her eyes. Does that not show us that one drink affects us? And people try to say that it doesn't. Well, anyway, verse 34, yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, and as he that lieth on the top of a mast. Now, you think about what was just said there. You lie down in the midst of the sea. What's going to happen if you lie in the midst of the sea? You're going to drown. What happens if you lie on the top of a sailing mast? You're going to fall off. Going right back to what he said in Proverbs 20, verse 1, you're a fool if you drink alcohol. Verse 35, they have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not hurt or sick. Hurt is the American Standard Version rendering. They have beaten me, and I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. Does that not show the foolishness there of drinking alcohol? In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 11, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 11. I'm kind of trying in a new Bible today. A little longer to turn the pages. But now I've written unto you not to keep company if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, or covetous, or an idolater, or a railer, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, with such a one know not to eat. If someone who is a Christian drinks alcohol, we're not even to eat with them. Don't even eat with them. They're to be withdrawn from. And in Galatians chapter 5, verse 19 tells us that drunkenness, and if you take one drink, you are one drink drunk. Drunkenness is a work of the flesh. Galatians 5, 19 to 21. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envies, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like. Now, you see the list here that drinking alcohol is compared with, right? You might as well be an adulterer or a fornicator or a liar or a jealous murderer and anything like it. Of the which I tell you before, as I've told you also in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. You drink alcohol, you're going to be in hell. That's what he's saying. And we need to convince ourselves of that and not try to justify our actions. But you know, many are going to argue there's nothing wrong with getting drunk, and getting drunk, it seems, is what people live for. Well, I'm going to go out this weekend and I'm going to get plastered. I'm going to get drunk. Why? Why on earth would somebody be so stupid as to do that? But you know, drinking and getting drunk leads to other sins. Fornication, theft, murder. It's just the beginning. It's the progression of sin. And Noah's getting drunk led to other sin and grave consequences in Noah's life and the lives of future generations of his family. Noah was in a shameful situation. Genesis 9, let's go back there and read verse 21 again. Genesis 9, 21. And he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. Noah was lying in a drunken stupor, naked in his tent. Adam and Eve knew the shame of being naked. Genesis chapter 3, verses 7 and 10. Genesis 3, 7 and 10. Says, and the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Verse 10, when Adam was talking to God, he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. They knew the shame of being naked. Aaron knew the shame of being naked. Go to Exodus 32. 25. Exodus 32, 25. And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked, unto their shame among their enemies. Nakedness is shame. Noah's drunkenness then led to his nakedness, did it not? And Noah's nakedness led to other sin. Go to Genesis 9 and let's read verses 22 to 27. Verses 22 to 27. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine, and knew what his younger son had done to him. And he said, Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Verse 26. And he said, Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. And Canaan shall be his servant. All right. Most commentators that I've read say that Ham sinned. The question is, did he? Well, such things as this are stated. Ham seems to have shown disrespect for his father. Another statement. He pleased himself with the sight. Perhaps Ham had been himself drunk. It is common for those who walk in false ways themselves to rejoice at the false steps which they sometimes see others make. He told his two brethren in a scornful, deriding manner that his father might seem vile unto them. I have a question. when we read through there, did you read any of that? Let's see. Let's go back and see what it said. Verse 22, and Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father was out and told his two nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Have you ever thought that maybe Ham came out of Noah's tent devastated because of what he had seen? Because of what had happened to his father? And he told his brother so the matter could be handled properly? You know, people do a lot of accusing Ham there, just like they do of Thomas, whenever Thomas doubted that Jesus was raised from the dead. But is there any evidence? There is none. And there are those that will admit that, those commentators that will. There's really no evidence as to what happened there, what the sin was. Now, was Ham Noah's youngest son? In chapter 9, verse 24, it says, you know, his youngest son had done to him. Well, Ham may not have been Noah's youngest son, because sons were usually listed in their order of birth. And how are they listed? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Go back to Genesis chapter 5, verse 32. Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham may have been Noah's second son. But Canaan was the youngest son of Ham. And who was cursed? It was Canaan. In Genesis chapter 10, verse 6, it says, the sons of Ham, Cush, and Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan. So Canaan was the youngest son of Ham. Canaan was the one who was cursed. Ham was not cursed, nor were any of the other children. We don't see the other children of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, and Phut, they're being cursed. You know, in the ancient world, grandsons were considered as sons. And grandson is not a Bible word. It's an English word. So Canaan is the one who was cursed. Notice chapter 9 here, verses 24 and 25 again. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done to him, and he said, cursed be Canaan. A servant shall he be unto his brethren. So the one who is cursed is the one that did something to Noah. What was the sin? We don't know. There's no need in even speculating what the sin would be. But regardless of who sinned or what the sin was, we see the progressive nature of sin. Starts with drunkenness, went to nakedness, went to something else, went to a curse of an entire nation. Because of sin, a nation would be almost destroyed and enslaved. You know, in the history of the Canaanites, we see they were basically destroyed during the time of Joshua. There were those that weren't. But those that weren't were made slaves by Solomon. Now I want to look at another example of the progressive nature of sin. And some of the time that we have left here, I want to look at a couple. One from the scriptures and another one from an event that took place. You think about David and Bathsheba. This is going to go to the time of the United Kingdom. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11, but it definitely shows the progression of sin. All right, first of all, in verse 1, you know, the year was expired and they'd gone out to, let me just read it. It came to pass after the year was expired at that time, or at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. All right, so David didn't go out with the war. Verse 2. It came to pass in an evening time that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. All right, you know, you stop right there. David saw a woman washing herself. Now, Ham did see Noah's father, didn't he? But would David have sinned if he had turned away? No. Would Ham have sinned if he had turned away and went out and got things squared away? I'm not saying that Ham didn't. Ham may have done the things that the commentators say. But I'm just saying, let's don't judge before we know the facts. And we don't know the facts. We do know the facts here, though, in 2 Samuel 11. Because the last part of verse 2 says, the woman was very beautiful to look upon. What was the problem? David kept looking. David kept looking. There's the lust. Now we see the fornication, verse 4. And David sent messengers and took her. And she came unto him, and he lay with her. For she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned to her house. You know, the second part, I missed verse 3, didn't I? This is the second part. David sent and inquired after the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? What should have happened there? David should have finally, all right, yep, no. Oh, but David wasn't that way at this point, was he? He committed fornication. He committed adultery. Both he and Bathsheba committed adultery here. But let's look at the next step in the progression of sin. The lies. Verses 6 and 7, or verse 5. Says the woman conceived and sent told David, I'm with child. Uh-oh. Got a problem here. She's having a child. People knew that David sent and inquired after her, and she came to him. Now she's gone back and she's pregnant. And Joab's out in the field battling, and so is her husband, Uriah the Hittite. Whoops. So what are we going to do? We're going to have to do some lying here to try to cover that sin up. That's what David's going to do. David sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah was coming to him, David demanding how Joab did and how the people did and how the war prospered. You know, how are things going in the war? Uriah was one of David's mighty men. And you just think, okay, any little runner could have come and told you this. Why do you have me here? Verse 8, David said to Uriah, go down to thy house, wash thy feet. And Uriah departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. But you know what was going on there? You go home, and you lie with your wife, and that way my sin will be covered. You'll think you're the father of the child, and everybody else will think you're the father of the child. Only me and Bathsheba will know the difference. Well, somebody else did too. His name is God. Do you know what? Uriah was infuriatingly loyal. Verse 9, but Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and went not down to his house. He didn't go. Verse 10, when they told David, saying, Uriah went not down to his house, David said to Uriah, camest thou not from thy journey? Why didst thou not go down to thine house? Well, Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to mine house and eat and drink and to lie with my wife as thou livest and as thy soul liveth? I will not do this thing. I'm not going to do it. You know, we're looking kind of at some treachery that's taking place here by David, aren't we? Verse 12, David said to Uriah, tarry here today, also tomorrow, and I will let thee depart. So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and tomorrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him, and he made him drunk. Let's see if we can get him drunk and go down to his house. But he wouldn't do it. And at even he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he went not down to his house. See the progression of sin? But then what happens? Murder. Lust, fornication, lies, treachery, murder. beginning there in verse 14. Came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter, saying, Set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die. What does a little look turn to? That look of lust? Came to pass, verse 16, when Joab observed the city, they assigned Uriah to a place where he knew that valiant men were. And the men in the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. There's the murder that took place. And you know what happens next? A seared conscience. Verse 25. Well, I want to read beginning in verse 22. To get you the setting here. So the messenger went, this is from Joab, and showed David all that Joab had sent him for. And the messenger said unto David, Surely the men prevailed against us, and came out unto us into the field, and we were upon them unto evening to the entering of the gate. And the shooters shot from off the wall upon thy servants, and some of the king's servants be dead. And thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. Now notice the seared conscience, verse 25. Then David said to the messenger, Thus shalt thou say unto Joab, Let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city, and overthrow and encourage thou him. Murder. Oh, but then let's keep lying. Verse 26, And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when the mourning was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife, and bare him a son. Stop there for a minute. What's he trying to do? He's trying to cover up his sin. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. I want to give you another example, and this is from Brother Don Walker. He said, A young woman was left by her lover and was in a state of great depression. A married man with whom she worked decided to have an affair with her in order to comfort her. Some would argue that what he did might well have been a noble deed, for the man acted out of concern for his friend. Well, here's the rest of the story. The man's wife learned of his adulterous adventure, could not cope with the trauma, and eventually committed suicide. One of his sons, disillusioned by the immorality of his father and the death of his mother, began a life of crime and was finally imprisoned for murder. Another son became a drunkard and was killed in an automobile accident that also claimed the lives of a mother and her two children. The progression of sin. You know, the progression of sin is spelled out quite well. Sin leads to destruction. Sin never stops at just one thing. Sin is progressive in nature. Look at television programming as a prime example. 50, 60 years ago, married people on TV had to be in separate beds. You think about the Lucy show, whatever it was. I Love Lucy. Lucy and Desi Arnaz, even though they were married in real life also, had to be in separate beds on that television program. And yet today, fornication is promoted on TV between consenting adults. You can't go 5 minutes without hearing a curse word. Our government has gone from protecting the rights of the individual for paying for the slaughter of babies in their mother's wombs. The morals of our nation have gone the way of barnyard animals. And even worse than that, because you're not going to see two roosters walking arm in arm out in a barnyard. But then many of them think that they're nothing more than an advanced animal on the evolutionary chain anyway. You think about that. We teach our children in school that they're nothing more than an animal, and then we wonder why they act like it. Sin is progressive. It will not stop. Sin leads to destruction. Sin is a reproach to a nation. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 34. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And sin will not stop in our lives until we put a stop to it, or sin overcomes us and we die. James 1, 14 and 15. James chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. Trying to get my pages separated here. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. If you tell one lie, you're going to have to tell others to cover it up. One little drink leads to fornication, abortion, and a seared conscience. One dance leads to lusting, resulting in lost virginity and a lifetime of sorrow. Missing one class period or one worship service on purpose leads to complete unfaithfulness. One small, seemingly insignificant sin will lead to an eternity of punishment. Sin is progressive in nature. One sin can lead to the destruction of an entire people. The destruction of the Canaanites began years earlier with a drunken patriarch laying naked in his tent. What will the sins that you and I have committed result in years from now? But you know, there's a bright side to this story. Jesus Christ came to this earth to die for our sins so that we don't have to face God's wrath. Nations may be destroyed because of sin, but our souls don't have to be. If we will be faithful and obedient to God, we will have forgiveness of sin and eternal life. Well, again, this is Don Boyd with the Blue Springs Church of Christ. I want to welcome or thank you for coming to be with us today, and I want to welcome you to be with us again next time. And if you're ever in Blue Springs, Missouri, come by and worship with us. We meet at 1000 Southwest Clark Road. We meet on Sunday morning at 9:30 for Bible class, 10:30 for worship, and then again at 6 Sunday evening for worship period. We also meet on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock for Bible classes and a devotional period. So thanks for being with us today. Look forward to being with you next time.
Thank you for listening today. We hope you enjoyed this program. You can find out more about Bibleway Media by visiting us at BibleWayMedia.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we encourage you to please share this program, to like it on social media. Thank you for being with us today.